The Pennywise is a proud supporter of Kootenai Co-op Radio.
John Simpkins Electronics is closing out and everything must go. All January, get great deals on home theater, audio, digital still and video cameras from Sony, JVC, and Yamaha, with some items below cost at John Simpkins Electronics on Baker Street in Nelson.
Let us assume a third toke, long and slow. You vaporize, and you take it in and in and in, and there is a sound like the crumpling of a plastic bread wrapper, or the crackling or the flame, and a tone, a
All right, this is Fan of the Cosmos.
There is a cheer. The gnomes have learned a new way to say who.
All right, welcome. This is Fan of the Cosmos, Infinite Moment. I'm your host, Dustin Sunflower. Dan is down with a neck injury. I had one just the other day where I yawned and it went... But we're going to be talking today about how pot smokers actually have better driving skills than most. And, oh, just one second. There's the phone ringing. Just one sec.
Hello? Who is this? Yeah, I'm on air. Call back in 10 minutes. Bye.
Oh, dear God. You gotta hate that. We're gonna be talking about how pot smokers are generally better drivers than you would ever imagine, and there's no reason why these laws should be in place. We'll be talking how Toronto area officers are gonna be subjected to drug testing. You got it. Now we're subjected to it, and now police officers will be subjected to it too, because of, you got it. They've been messing around, so it's their turn. We'll also be talking about Bolivia's water situation. You may wonder what that has to do with us, but guess what? We're in the womb of water here in the Kootenays, and very, very important. And so let's cut to a tune. We'll also be having a Terrence McKenna session, our weekly segment of Bad Cop, No Donut, and whatever shenanigans I can come up with on the fly. Hope everybody had a wonderful day at the hill today. I guess there was some fresh sprinkling. And, it looks like it's been pretty nice out there. So, this is a warning going out to all.
Sending out a warning. Yeah, you know, star. How this one dedicated to our massive sin.
Yeah.
one is a warning. But this one is a warning. This one is a warning. But if you listen to the warning, come now. This is a warning. See who the gap fits up on them and this with madness. I'm one like a terrorist. What a thing you know here, you blaze up the district. They see Larry Slim, they keep on sitting up in the pain. Come on, never give a damn, I'm against some of the profit. Otherwise, they might look reflective the next trick. Why? How would they lick them muscles supersonic? Well, they got the badness, I'm going to be saving a target. It's a warning. But this one is a warning. This one is a warning. If you listen to the warning, this one is a warning. But this one is a warning. This one is a warning. But this one is a warning. This is a warning. This total mentality check. They have the division captivate them. They hold your interest. I never claim to be the best, but nevertheless, them can't test consciousness. I'm gonna left them speechless. Ooh, they were in a crisis. A sign of the time. Revelation and defensive. Put on a seat, you must be blind. Political ideology, I'm gonna get left behind. They can't check up on you. They want to hear the bell chimes. Are they warning? But this one is a warning. This one is a warning. But if you listen to the warning, this one is a warning. But this one is a warning. This one is a warning. But this one is a warning. Give me no sign.
Step up and take your best right? Best shot, shot.
This one is a warning. But this one is a warning. This one is a warning. But if you listen to the warning, come now. People get hostile, look at a man get savage. You give them a instant quick to come take advantage. But if you listen, then I be get a impartial knowledge. Millennium is a distance, I be carry the message. It's a the warning. But this one is a warning.
As soon as you come into this dive, I think you get held in this sort of amazing force-shielded temporal warp thing.
All right, welcome back. You're listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio, 93.5 FM CJLY, broadcasting live from Nelson and over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaicoopradio.com. And if you're those lucky people living down on the Kootenai Lake, you're listening at 96.5 FM. It's late night there. It's already midnight. Oh, no, it's already 11 o'clock. So, yeah, I guess that one-hour time change kind of puts it on the late end of things. Now, this is a public service announcement from Fane of the Cosmos, Kootenai Co-op Radio. Every time you buy cocaine, You are supporting the abuse, rape, and pillage of indigenous peoples all over the world. Every time you buy cocaine, you're supporting the American government's actions, covert actions in other countries. Every time you buy cocaine, you are supporting the people who are trying to oppress us. Every time you buy cocaine, you are supporting the system of oppression. Every time you buy cocaine, you're putting money into the hands of evil people who are doing evil things throughout the world, who are spraying the ecological beauty of South America, who are destroying the indigenous peoples of Colombia, Venezuela, Bolivia, Guatemala, all the South American countries, all the Central American countries. Every time you buy cocaine, you're hurting people. Every time you buy cocaine, you are supporting the evil in the world. So, please reconsider. You're talking to a guy who supports cognitive liberty in its every aspect. I support people taking any drug they choose. But what I'm saying is that when you choose cocaine, you're choosing to support, like, you're hurting people. You're hurting other people in other parts of the world. And you don't know it because you don't grow coca here. Coca doesn't come from Canada. Coca isn't grown in North America. Coca is grown in South America. Coca is grown in Central America. Coca is grown in other parts of the world. And the American government has their fingers there. And they oppress the people there. And so when you buy it, yeah, you might, I'm totally support you in being free in your body and your mind, and that you have cognitive liberty, that you have the ability, the right, the, you know, the spiritual birthright to put whatever you want into your body. But what I'm saying is that when you choose cocaine, you're hurting people. Mushrooms, they just grow on the earth. They grow everywhere, including North America, on the West Coast. When you do LSD, hey, it's synthesized right here. When you smoke pot, you know what's going down. The Kootenays, they got it. You don't have to worry. When you're buying pot in the Kootenays, you're not supporting an oppressive regime in another country. So, I'm just saying, I'm just having a rough time with it these days. It seems to be rampant in our community, and yet it has such evil consequences for the poor people elsewhere in the world. Last week we spoke about Colombia and Venezuela and how money is being used from cocaine importation by the American government to support military action in Colombia that is aimed directly at the multinational corporations' interests in Venezuela. And the poor people in those countries are trying to rise up. They're trying to say, look, we don't want to be slaves to the coca plant. Our people have used it for thousands of years without problems, but now you come in, their standard of living goes down, there's rape, there's pillage, their waters are poisoned by aerial spraying. They don't need that. And the reason that that's happening is because every one of you who's doing coke tonight or any other night is funding them. You're giving them the money to hurt these people. And these are the people with the myths and the legends and the, they have a consciousness. Their layer of consciousness is as important as our Celtic heritage, as our African heritage, as any of our heritages. Because if you think of ecology, there's an ecology of consciousness. And in those people's minds and beliefs, in those rainforests, there's a consciousness there that is like the wilderness of the mind. It is like an old-growth forest. Their myths have been handed down, unobstructed, for thousands of years. Ours have been mashed, mangled. And so it's very, very important that those people are kept alive. And every time you buy cocaine, you're cutting them off. You're cutting down their forests so they can grow more coca for the coca lords. So the American government can import that cocaine and put it on the streets and subjugate the black communities and the poor people of America so they can punish them, and it's evil. It's so evil. So please, please, this is a public service announcement from Fane of the Cosmos. Please stop supporting the cocaine lords throughout the world. Now, just because that's been so heavy, I'll play something kind of on the light side, okay? Here we go. Just to lighten things up, because I know that was a little heavy.
I snorted cocaine for about 15 years with my dumb ass. I must have snorted up Peru. I could have bought Peru all the shit I snorted. Could have just gave them the money up front and had me a piece of property. I started off snorting little tiny pinches. Said, I know I ain't gonna get hooked. Not on no coke, you can't get hooked. My friends have been snorting 15 years, they ain't hooked. I started snorting little teeny, didn't even make noise. Coke etiquette, Jack.
Pass the album, please. No more for me.
6 months later. Licking the album shit. Trying to get a freeze. Somebody told me you put it on your dick, you could fuck all night. Right? Shouldn't have told me that. My dick had a Jones. $600 a day just to get my dick hard. And you get weird sexual fantasies too when you be on coke. Just sling up some weird. Baby, I got a great idea. I want you to go out on the roof. I'm gonna run around the house 3 times. On the 3rd time, I want you to jump off on my face. Got a witness. Them niggas pointing at each other. Niggas will not admit to giving up no head. Not yet, even then. No, nah. Not the kid. No. Nah. Nah, I ain't no termite. No. Be lying their ass off. Right, and black women like head, but they won't kiss you afterward. Right? No, no. No, it's bad for your teeth. No. It's better to give than receive. And dudes be trying to talk a lot of shit on cocaine too, right? Be thinking they making plenty of sense. Don't be saying shit. Baby, shit, I nix and shit in my shit, goddamn. And the pimps get psychotic when they get high. Them motherfuckers get all the moves together, right? Shit, I'm down, in it. I got a little down, you know what I mean? I'm down. Now the men scream on me and say, I'm doing amazing, you know? I got 500, you know? Talking about the men, now, I got anything on. I'm down to wait on the line, you know? But I'm on the, over in the gun, see? No, no, nigga, this is I'm doing on my, you know, I'm going to hold the mess. I ain't holding the motherfucking thing. You know what I'm going to do, huh? Ha, 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 ha. You know, huh? Yeah. I'm ready for Freddy. You know what I mean? And now, niggas be holding them dicks too, Jack. White people go, why do you guys hold your things? So you done took everything else, motherfucker. Nigga be checking. You can't tell nobody not to snort no coke, cause motherfuckers gonna snort anyway. It took me a long time to learn that shit kill you. Man, but a big booger came out of my nose, scared the shit out of me. That motherfucking black one this long. I said, God damn,
Lord, please, I'll quit, please. Just let it stop.
Okay, welcome back. That was Richard Pryor, obviously, doing a kind of more jokey kind of end of things. Don't like to be too heavy, but what I've seen on the scene is almost too much for me. And when you know what you know about the poor people in other countries, and when they cry out with their blood, then you get pissed off about cocaine. But Richard Pryor, he can make it funny for you. Now, this is, many of you can remember last year when the cops set up a roadblock at the bottom of Whitewater, intent on busting people who were smoking marijuana, and how they, you know, they were like, it's affecting your driving and your ability to enjoy snowboarding and skiing. And we know full well that's bullshit, but anyway, the cops set up this roadblock. It was kind of one of those psych-ops things, you know, like mental psychological terrorism. You're going to go have fun up at the hill, are you? Well, you're busted. So I don't necessarily agree with that. And let's roll out the studies on smoking pot and driving. 2 decades of research have shown that marijuana may actually reduce driver accidents. The effects of marijuana use on driving performance have been extensively researched over the last 20 years. All major studies show that marijuana consumption has little or no effect on driving ability. Little or no effect. And may actually reduce accidents. Here's a summary of the biggest studies into pot use and driving. This is a 1983 study by the U.S. National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, concluded that the only significant effect of cannabis use was slower driving, arguably a positive effect of driving high. A comprehensive 1992 NHTSA, the U.S. National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, revealed that pot is rarely involved in driving accidents, except when combined with alcohol. The study concluded that the THC-only drivers had an accident responsibility rate below that of the drug-free drivers. This study was buried for 6 years and not released until 1998. So what they're saying is that if you smoke pot, you actually drive better than people who don't smoke pot. So there we go. A 1993 U.S. National Highway Transportation Safety Administration dosed Dutch drivers with THC and tested them on real Dutch roads. It concluded that THC caused no impairment except for a slight deficiency in the driver's ability to, quote, maintain a steady lateral position on the road, unquote. This means that the THC dosed drivers had a little trouble staying smack in the center of their lanes, but showed no other problems. The study noted that the effects of even high doses of THC were far less than that of alcohol or many prescription drugs. The study concluded that THC's adverse effects on driving performance appear relatively small. Alright, so we have 3 studies now. How about the 1998, a huge study by the University of Adelaide and Transport South Australia, and they examined the blood samples from drivers involved in 2,500 accidents. It found that drivers with only cannabis in their systems were slightly less likely to cause accidents than those without. Drivers with both marijuana and alcohol did have a high accident responsibility rate. The report concluded there was no indication that marijuana by itself was a cause of fatal accidents. All right. Study number 5. In Canada, a 1999 University of Toronto meta-analysis of studies into pot and driving showed that drivers who consumed a moderate amount of pot typically refrained from passing cars and drove at a more consistent speed. The analysis also confirmed that marijuana alone does not increase a driver's risk of causing an accident. And your final and beautiful study, A major study done by the UK Transport Research Laboratory in 2000 found that drivers under the influence of cannabis were more cautious and less likely to drive dangerously. The study examined the effects of marijuana use on drivers through 4 weeks of tests on driving simulators. The study was commissioned specifically to show that marijuana was impairing, and the British government was embarrassed with the study's conclusion that marijuana users actually drive safer than people who are not high. So, the next time a police officer pulls you over and says, "Have you been smoking marijuana?" you can say, "Officer, for road safety, I'd have to say yes." So, folks, anytime someone gives you hell for driving stoned, you're actually doing the world a favor because you're more likely to drive safely. The Canadian government is set to establish drug impairment as part of their new Bill C-17, which says that people who are impaired by a drug can be fined and treated like someone who is, like an impaired driver. This is completely wrong. CRTC rules state I cannot say swear words too often, so I won't. But so we are safer drivers, us cannabis smokers, and all the proof is there. If you want studies, they exist. If you go to cannabisculture.com, you can see the studies. You can hit the links and actually get the study. So if you are a person who's involved with a supposed cannabis impaired driving charge, or you've got a 215 impairment thing, you can fight it. There is a way. And hell, if you're busted for simple possession of pot and you're driving and they want to charge you, talk to me, Fane of the Cosmos, Dustin Sunflower, and I will help you get these studies and help you fight it. So, yeah, I'm there for you if you want to do it. Now, this is a tune that Paul D. found. It's a mini, and we'll go to Bad Cop No Donut after this. This is from Cassette Boy, and it's called Drugs.
Adolescents who try drugs will find themselves
up all night
on drugs,
up all night
on the drugs,
on the drugs,
up all night,
up all night,
up all night.
For parents across the country, drugs help to control children.
Babies and children need cocaine because they enjoy the high.
Substances, chemicals, drugs,
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 drugs. That's all. Just drugs.
Well, I think that if you really want to try and understand behavior, then you have to do more. Illegal drugs.
The public needs drugs.
Use illegal drugs.
Drugs, drugs, drugs make you hide your face again. Now the drugs work, they don't make you worse. I know I'll see the drugs again. Yeah, I know I'll see the drugs again. I know I'm on the drugs again.
Drugs are boring. Drugs is just so boring.
Forget about the drugs, it ain't.
This is Bad Cop No Donut for the week of January 13th, 2005.
I freeze! Police!
Bad Cop No Donut!
Bad, 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 bad.
Cop, 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 cop.
No, 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 no. Donut, 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 donut.
It's under law, and I rule.
With your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption, I'm Ron Anisich at CKLN in Toronto. A woman who claims she was raped by a Louisville, Kentucky police officer has filed a lawsuit in federal court. In her lawsuit, the woman says that last January, Officer Billy Ray White entered her home, pointed his weapon at her, and forced her to have sex with him in front of her infant daughter. He then threatened to kill the woman if she told anyone. In her lawsuit, She holds the city liable for hiring an officer with a history of abusive behavior towards women. White, who resigned from the force in May, has pleaded not guilty to charges of rape, intimidating a participant in the legal process, tampering with a witness, tampering with public records, tampering with physical evidence, and official misconduct. Two police officers and a department volunteer in East Palo Alto, California, are under investigation for beating a man unconscious last August. During a probe by the county district attorney, the officers said they had confronted a drug suspect who they chased until he disappeared. But the youth volunteer and the victim told of a beating that ended with the victim being left bleeding and unconscious. Eventually, the victim made his way home and then to a hospital. Both officers are still on duty as the district attorney has not decided yet on whether or not to file charges. The department is also conducting its own investigation, during which both officers accused in the beating remain on active duty. A county judge in Florida has ruled that the city of Jacksonville's public drinking ban is unconstitutional. Last month, Jacksonville police officer Caleb Underwood killed a man while arresting him for drinking in public. Underwood has since resigned from the force for other past misconduct. 2 days later, another man died in Jacksonville police custody. Both of those deaths are being investigated by the FBI and the United States Justice Department. Last week, we told you about a man who claims he was severely beaten by Jacksonville police on Christmas Eve. This week, it appears that there has been yet another death in custody involving Jacksonville police. On Sunday, a man who was being booked into the Duval County Jail by Jacksonville officers died. The man, arrested after a disturbance at a hospital, collapsed while being taken to be fingerprinted. Police claim that there was no physical confrontation with the man at any time. A man in Eunice, Louisiana, has settled his police brutality lawsuit out of court. The man was beaten by Eunice police officers when they arrested him for disturbing the peace at his high school reunion. Both state authorities and the FBI investigated the beating after the man filed a lawsuit naming four officers and the chief of the department. Reports in the local media suggest that the man has accepted an offer of $35,000 to settle the lawsuit. This week, it was reported that Taser International is under investigation for claims made about the safety of their products from both the United States Securities and Exchange Commission and the Arizona Attorney General's office. The company manufactures stun guns for North America's police forces. The company acknowledged the investigations last week. The SEC is also looking into a large sale of weapons at the end of last year that is suspected to have been an attempt to inflate annual sales figures. Growing numbers of media reports, in addition to reports by Amnesty International and the U.S. military, suggest that Taser's claim that no one has ever been killed by one of its products is fairly absurd. Tasers use a 50,000-volt shock to subdue their targets, either through direct contact or through wire barbs that hook onto skin when fired from the taser and are connected to the handheld unit by a pair of 20-foot wires. Some police departments have backed away from plans to purchase stun guns in the future, and other departments have restricted their use or implemented technology to track when the devices are being used by their officers. Most North American police departments, however, stand by the use of stun guns as an alternative to the use of lethal force. Meanwhile, people appear to be dying at an alarming rate. In Arizona, the home state of Taser International, the newspaper The Arizona Republic reports 11 deaths resulting from Taser use. An Amnesty International report released in November linked 74 deaths to the use of stun guns in the United States and Canada. In Canada, there have been at least 6 coroner's inquests into deaths linked to the use of Tasers. Last month, 3 people were killed by Florida police in taser-related incidents. On Saturday, police in Pensacola, Florida, killed a man with a taser after he broke into a residence owned by members of his family and argued with them. Escambia County Sheriff's deputies say they shocked the man twice after he resisted arrest. Football fans at the Fiesta Bowl in Utah last week were tasered by police, who were trying to keep them off the playing field after the game. At least one child was shot with a stun gun at that event. Jury selection began this week in a civil lawsuit against the chief of the Niles, Ohio Police Department almost a decade after the events which led to the suit. Chief Bruce Simeon was on his way to an emergency in April 1986 when his car crashed into another vehicle which was carrying two occupants. The passenger was killed instantly, and the driver died after spending 6 weeks in a coma. The first part of the trial will determine if the chief and the city are liable in the deaths of the two men. If successful, the families of the two men will proceed to a second trial, where the amount of damages to be awarded will be decided. The second trial is scheduled to take place in April. A school principal in Springfield, Massachusetts, who was beaten by police during a diabetic attack in November, is suing the officers. The man says he pulled his car into a convenience store parking lot when he began to feel disoriented. A store clerk called the police when he noticed the man's car had been parked for some time. When police arrived, they smashed the car windows and dragged the man through them, even though the car's doors were unlocked. The man's lawsuit described how he was beaten, kicked, and choked by officers Jeffrey Asher, James Kervick, James Shuchuk, and James Moriarty. The lawsuit also refers to five other unidentified officers. The man says he repeatedly told the officers of his condition and said he needed juice or sugar. He claims the officers then continued to kick and beat him with nightsticks and a flashlight and accused him of being on drugs when they opened his briefcase and discovered his insulin and syringes. The four named officers have been placed on paid administrative leave.
Mr. Nin's case would be the third time that this officer has used unreasonable force, has used unlawful force against citizens of St. Paul.
Police in St. Paul, Minnesota, are investigating one of their own officers who allegedly pepper-sprayed and beat an 85-year-old man during a traffic stop. The man was bringing cupcakes and sandwiches to his wife at a nursing home when he was pulled over by Officer Michael Lee for having expired license tags. The man says Lee was belligerent because he failed to pull over quickly enough. Police say the man attacked the officer. The man was arrested and spent 2 days in jail before he was released. After his release, he sought medical treatment at a hospital. Lee has not been suspended during the investigation. In 2001, Officer Lee accidentally shot a man who had been carjacked and who had managed to get a gun away from his attacker. Lee was cleared of any wrongdoing in that killing. Further allegations have come to light in the case of Whitehall, Wisconsin police officer Daniel Wineski, who was sentenced in November to 7 years in prison for forcing a 14-year-old girl to perform a sex act on him in his squad car in 1996. Wineski avoided a trial by pleading guilty to the charges. Because of a statute of limitations, Wineski was never charged with any of these additional crimes, but prosecutors planned to introduce the evidence at the officer's trial had he not pleaded guilty. In addition to the charge involving the 14-year-old, there are a number of other complaints against Wineski. After a traffic stop in 1981, he forced a girl to go to a park where he handcuffed her and placed his hands up her shirt and down her shorts. He's accused of groping a girl who was being taken into custody for underage drinking in 1986. Wineski is accused of hugging and kissing a 15-year-old girl in her bedroom while conducting surveillance related to a theft. He's also accused of propositioning a 17-year-old who he was questioning regarding disorderly conduct. The woman said she made out with Wineski on several occasions and that he fondled her while he was in uniform and on duty. A woman told police that when she was 18 years old and was intoxicated, she had sex with Wineski at a police station. While writing a citation for underage drinking, Wineski offered to destroy it for a 14-year-old girl in exchange for sex. When she refused, he gave her 24 hours with which to change her mind before he dropped the citation off at her parents' house. Wineski is also accused of buying beer for a teenage girl and then forcing her to have sex with him. Recently, one of the other women sexually assaulted by Wineski when she was a teen told her story to a local newspaper. You can read the interview with her at the La Crosse Tribune website. A police officer in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, has been sentenced to probation for mistakenly going on a drunken rampage in a house which the officer had mistaken for his girlfriend's, who actually lived next door. Officer Joseph Brown inflicted thousands of dollars of damage to the property in the incident, which happened last spring. In addition to the 12 months of probation, he has been ordered to pay almost $4,000 in restitution and to undergo an alcohol abuse evaluation. Brown resigned from the department in May, a month after the incident. By then, his supervisors were investigating four other episodes of violence or misconduct committed by the officer, all between March and April. The father of a man killed by police in Brownsville, Pennsylvania last May filed a $100 million civil lawsuit this week. The lawsuit claims the man was shot in the back as he drove away from the officers and that he was then pulled from his truck and beaten by officers while he was bleeding to death. The man later died at a hospital. The lawsuit claims that officers Autumn Fike, Mark Costello, Josh Mrosko, and Dennis Field deliberately killed their victim after a 6-mile slow-speed chase. Police began the chase after spotting the man in an area he had been told to leave the night before. A coroner's inquest has already recommended that the officers involved with the incident not be charged. The Tennessee Bureau of Investigation is investigating an allegation that the Ethbridge police chief beat a 58-year-old grandmother who had not committed a crime. The woman says that Chief E.O. Shelton brutalized her at the Ethbridge City Hall last Wednesday morning, kicking, beating, and choking her until she lost consciousness. During the attack, the officer had to be told to get off of the woman by another officer. Shelton is currently on paid leave. A police officer in Detroit has been charged with providing stolen drugs to addicts in connection to a website which he ran. Officer Sierre Campbell is accused of stealing drugs from the narcotics unit where he worked and providing them to as many as 50 drug users. He then photographed them using the marijuana, crack cocaine, and heroin for his website. He then charged visitors to his website a fee to view the footage. Campbell's trial begins next week. Police in Syracuse, New York, are accused of beating a 16-year-old. The boy admits he was running from police when he fell. He claims that several officers then attacked him with a flashlight and kicked him. The boy was charged with possession of stolen property and resisting arrest. The boy's family is considering a lawsuit. A police investigation is underway. A detective in Boston is under investigation for false testimony given to a grand jury. Officer Eve D'Amberville was placed on administrative leave on December 6th after he failed to follow proper procedure while showing photo arrays to a victim of a crime. The officer then lied about the events when he testified before a grand jury. The case against the alleged perpetrators of the crime was eventually thrown out of court because of problems with the identification procedure followed by the officer. A police officer in Houston is on trial this week for murdering a 14-year-old in November 2003. Officer Arthur Carboneau claims to have killed the boy accidentally during a struggle, but prosecutors say he was killed deliberately. The 14-year-old was being stopped by the officer because he expected the boy was involved in an assault he was investigating. Carboneau claims his gun went off when the boy kicked him in the arm. The boy was shot at close range in the head. Other than the killings already mentioned, police also killed people this week in Louisville, Kentucky, where police killed two people within 9 hours last Thursday, bringing their total to 13 since 1998. Las Vegas, where police killed a man who had stolen some CDs from a drugstore, the third fatal shooting by Las Vegas police in 3 weeks. Longmont, Colorado, where police shot and killed a 61-year-old woman in her home. And Ceres, California, where police killed a U.S. Marine after a standoff. Email your comments and story ideas to ihatepigs@hotmail.com. That's all for this week. Tune into this station next week for more. From CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto, I'm Ron Anisich. Every week we end Bad Cop, No Donut with a song. This week it's Police Story by Black Flag. We'll be right back.
aggressive terrorists of America. They've never stopped bombing in Iraq. Tell me what, that's really dark. 1,500,000 Iraqis died.
Remember Iraq, remember Iran.
It blow up New York, it blow up New York.
Fly an aeroplane in the New York streets. Blow up the World Trade Center, commit suicide like my man from Afghanistan.
Fly me to New York. I've got a razor in my pocket. You think you've flown before? Wait till you lock in my plane. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding my knife deep in the heart of you. I'm round the bend, I'm mental, and I'm flying the plane. Let's fly into buildings. Let's turn to ashes, 'cause I'm dying on a jet plane. I know I won't be back again.
The World Trade Center.
And now my skin is melting away.
Look, here comes another aeroplane.
The WTC.
Burns like a tower in inferno.
We burn twin towers.
Let the motherfucker burn.
Buildings knocked down.
Down to the ground.
The buildings collapse, creating casualties. World Trade Center.
Buried you alive.
Dismembered bodies at ground zero.
To blame.
America.
There's no one but yourself to blame.
Let's talk about war over oil. Let's talk about the oil. Let's talk about the needs for the oil in the U.S. soil.
All right, you're listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio, 93.5 FM, CJLY, broadcasting live from Nelson over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaicoopradio.com and 96.5 FM, Kootenai Lake. That was Bad Cop, No Donut, runs, I can't remember his name now, but anyway, out of Toronto, sweet show. I try not to get too down on cops, but we have our names thrown in the papers all the time about how bad people are doing crimes in the States to keep the fear up. Well, sometimes the fear is within their own department. Now, in Toronto, this is from Metro Ontario, unions vow to challenge move. Police officers in high-risk jobs from chief on down will have to submit to drug testing, psychological evaluations, and probes of their bank accounts starting March 1st. Announced yesterday, the controversial measures would be the last of the recommendations put into action from a report on how to repair public confidence in the scandal-racked Toronto Police Service. In a news release, Chief Julian Fantino acknowledged that drug testing is a highly contentious matter, opposed by rank and file and many senior officers alike. Toronto Police Association President Dave Wilson called the plan an absolute intrusion on the lives of our officers and said the union would fight it. Quote, it will be challenged by the association at every level, into the courts and all the way, unquote, he said. Fantino, meanwhile, stood by an earlier promise to take a drug test. I am leaving, as you know, on the 28th of February, but I'm willing to do it, he said. Fantino is said to be the front runner to replace Dr. James Young as Ontario's Commissioner of Emergency Management. The closer scrutiny of Toronto officers is the last of the recommendations in the report on preventing police misconduct written by retired Judge George Ferguson. If the plan goes ahead, Toronto will be the first police service in Canada to test officers for illegal drug use. Such testing is common in the United States. The whole thing is on an informed consent basis, Ferguson said. If a member of the service does not wish to be subjected to the testing plan, then that person will not be disciplined. That person will just not be assigned or promoted to those areas. Now we see it. So here we have now a police force getting drug testing, not criminals, not nurses, not truck drivers, but actual cops. And so it's kind of like, you know, how pissed off they are about having to do that, about having to take drug tests, about having to pee into a cup, about having to give blood, about having to breathe into breathalyzers. Well, guess what? We're subjected to it all the time to get jobs, to do all kinds of things. And even when you're on parole, or, you know, they can be conditions of your parole. No one likes to do that. And so now cops can feel what it's like to have to undergo drug testing, to feel how inhuman it is to have parts of your body taken away to be analyzed, to have your urine, you know, to piss away your life into a cup so that someone can see if you're doing drugs. And I guess you don't get tested for pharmaceutical drugs, just illegal drugs. It's kind of funny, don't you think? What are we going to do now? Let's just see. This is a really sweet album that I just, that we just got at the store that I just love. It's, Funkin' Fusion. And it's from You Got It Ninja Tunes at the Hitters. Yeah. Okay, we're gonna go to a little Terrence McKenna here. I love this guy, and it's a shame I never ever got to interview him. He did email me once when the coppers had charged the Holy Smoke Boys with possession for the purpose of trafficking and simple possession for mushrooms, and we had a huge case where we were gonna go to the top with the whole mushroom argument, and I emailed Terrence McKenna and asked him if he had any ideas or he'd like to testify and stuff. He's like, well, not right now, I can't really do anything about it, but good luck, Dustin. And so that's the only interaction I ever got to do with Terrence McKenna, but I know that if he was around, I would somehow get him up here to talk. So let's go to Terrence McKenna. This is Man and Woman, which is very important in this time that men and women get back to the earth. And I know last week someone was kind of perturbed with the word fraternity. Fraternity means the equal balance of sexes to working together. It's not fraternity as in university fraternity, which I don't know how they usurp that term, but it's, I just don't like that. So here's Terrence McKenna. Enjoy.
Can you all hear what I'm saying?
Yeah. Oh yeah, Terrence.
Can you all hear what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And how many of you can see what I'm saying? Before I tell you the story that I came here to tell, I will talk a little bit about the practical side of what we've been discussing in the past couple of days as it impacts on the life of my partner and myself. We're going to talk a lot this morning about plants, and it will be about plants as they were used thousands of years ago and in places far distant from here. But implicit in what I'm saying is very real-world work that we're doing in Hawaii to preserve plants with a history of human and shamanic usage. Because our focus of interest is the Amazon and shamanism, we've concentrated in that area. But throughout the world, there are, as you know well, very fragile ecosystems on the brink of disappearing forever. But even more fragile than these natural ecosystems is the web and legacy of human understanding that has been gathered through the millennia by the native peoples.
Oh my God, listeners, this is exactly what I was talking about in the whole cocaine thing. This is it. This is what exactly what I'm talking about. He's talking about the ecological fragility, but there's also the fragile space of human consciousness, human mythology, human, that higher consciousness, the shamanic realms. This is it. He's talking about it. This is why when you buy cocaine, they're destroying the people who are kind of the stewards of that space. So, let's go back.
In these areas, and throughout the warm tropics especially, the impact is very great. The young men and women are not apprenticing themselves to the elder shamans. The men go off to work in sawmills, the women become waitresses. They are being sucked into the engine of world capitalism. And in a single generation, this legacy of plant information that reaches back 20, 50,000 years will in large measure be lost. We're seeing this in the Amazon. Much has already been lost. So Kat and I and Richard Evans Schultes of Harvard and Rupert Sheldrake, Ralph Abraham, Ralph Metzner, Frank Barr, a number of people have gathered together and formed a nonprofit foundation whose showcase project is a 19-acre botanical garden in Hawaii that preserves these plants and supports native collectors in Peru and other places so that this botanical material can be preserved with no real plan for it other than its preservation. It is there available to psychotherapists, biochemists, homeopathists, anyone who has a legitimate angle on these things. So I want to mention that to you this morning because we always are soliciting support, not only financial support, but donations of time and equipment. And if you come to the Hawaiian Islands, you could put us into your loop at times when we are there, and we would be happy to show you around. The garden is at about 2,200 feet above sea level with 70 inches of rainfall a year, which at 19 degrees north, which is what it is, approximately duplicates what's going on in the montane rainforest of the equator at about 8,500 feet, which is the so-called cloud forest. So it's a beautiful place. It's a highly charged place because magical plants from throughout the world are growing there. And I mention it to show that we don't entirely live in our heads in these matters. The Big Island of Hawaii. The Big Island is larger than all the other Hawaiian islands combined, and it has fewer people than any other island. It's where, if old Hawaii lingers on at all, it's probably in the desolate districts of the Big Island. Well, so that's enough of that. Now I want to address the concerns that we've been dealing with over the past 2 days. And from my perspective, we sort of designed this weekend with the notion of showcasing Rian's thought, and I think we've done that very well. And for those of you who haven't had a chance to hear her, she very kindly has promised to join me this afternoon. She didn't originally intend that, but we have a very fertile kind of dialogue going among all the people who have been here over the past 2 days. And so we will return to that to put what I'm going to say this morning in context, I just want to briefly review the basis of her theory. It is quite simply that the absence of patriarchy does not imply matriarchy. The natural and most long-running form of human organization is what Rian has named partnership society. Partnership societies were the norm up until, pick a number, 4,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, in any case, eventually falling with the fall of Minoan Crete to Mycenaean invaders around 1000 BC, and that set us into the era of dominator cultures, which she believes, and I agree with her, is a temporary, I won't say aberration, a temporary necessary adaptation, but one that we can now move beyond. My Rian's approach is basically to say what happened, that there was partnership society, and then she's very insistent that there was a confluence of factors which caused the shift from the partnership society to the dominator culture. I, being cast more in the fanatical mode, prefer to think that there was one major cause, and that its adumbrations can be explicated by the methods of archaeology, good logic, and a little visionary imagining. And so I want to tell you the story this morning. Remember, I said yesterday the best idea will win. And so we're sort of in a contest in the manner of the great Celtic poetry contests of old, where the person who can dream up the best idea will have the satisfaction of seeing it realized. And if you want to do that kind of total revisioning of the position of human beings in the world, I think you have to take at first a deconstructionist approach and take away everything that impedes the construction of the new point of view. So I want to take away a number of notions and just get rid of them. One notion is that nature is a competition of tooth and claw, and that the swiftest, the fiercest, the meanest will always come out on top. This is just a notion that was attractive to a Victorian gentleman who happened to be in charge of a world-screwing empire at the time. Any modern biologist will tell you that what is being maximized in biological systems is cooperation, integration, mutual reinforcement, and mutual meeting of need. Obviously, if an organism can insinuate itself into the energy loop of another organism, it will have more of its own energy to play with. And this is the strategy that is operating, especially on the microbial level, in the earth, around the roots of plants. You know, there are mycorrhizal relationships, fungi that surround the roots of plants, mediate and buffer the liquids passing into the plants, and in turn have a release of nutrients that supports them. We see symbiosis in all kinds of situations in nature. What has never been really even suggested, let alone researched, is that perhaps the unique qualities that attend our own species are somehow reinforced and stabilized by our own symbiotic relationship, that we are also symbiotes of some sort to other organisms in nature. Now, a symbiotic relationship can be broken apart. The little fish which live in the protection of the tentacles of anemones and thereby draw larger fish in for the anemones to feed upon can live in the absence of the anemone. But when they do, they produce smaller individuals that experience a shorter lifespan and the population is generally more limited. So when a creature that has evolved a symbiotic relationship is through catastrophe or design separated from the other member of the pair, life goes on, but there is a sense of burden, a sense of moving against the flow, a sense of abandonment. Well, this sense of abandonment, being moved against the flow, is a very good description of the psychological set we inherit at the beginning of our history. Because as we discussed a little bit yesterday, our history begins with us being tossed out of a garden by Jehovah as Narc, because the woman had exercised her right to conscious self-exploration and awareness by eating of the fruit of the tree of life. It suggests to me that it was the relationship with the fruit of the tree of life that made early human beings somehow co-equal with the dragon god who was the keeper of the garden. So that the fall into history is a mythological way of saying that we were separated very early from something very dear to us. It was rent away from us. And inevitably, the image that must come into all our minds is the image of a child being separated from its mother. Well, in the present dialogue within the New Age, we've gotten to the point of sharing the notion that we have become separated from the mother, our Earth. But it operates at the level of a kind of poetic notion or a reassuring abstraction. I mean, how do we reconnect to our mother, the Earth? By talking about it? By how is it done through agriculture? Or is that a violation of the mother? How is it to be done? Well, what I'm going to say this morning is sort of a blend of myth, mania, and science, where we take the best from each category and try to weave together an argument that would convince a skeptic. So those of you who have heard me do this before, bear with me. It grows in my mind. I adumbrate detail. It has to be made tighter and tighter and ever more convincing. Because the goal is, if we can change the myths about our origins, we can change the expectation about our future. Because the future, the post-historical future, is somehow going to be a revivifying of the myth of origin. So if we go into it with the wrong myth, we may get in trouble. And I think a patriarchal, egocentric, Apollonian, Solarian myth that would send us sort of as insect robots to the stars in spaceships the size of Manhattan, it needs, is unbalanced. A certain leavening. Okay, so enough with prologue. Here is the story. The story begins a long time ago, and it has no beginning, because at its inception it's locked in to the geological and geophysical mechanics of the planet. It begins somewhere in the last 4 million years with a slow drying trend across the northern hemisphere of the planet, affecting especially the tropical forests of Africa, which at this time are unbroken from north to south. And over the next 1.5 million years, Africa grows progressively drier, not desert. It was not even desert as recently as Roman times. Pliny describes the Sahara Desert as the breadbasket of Rome. But over 1.5 million years, Africa grew drier, and the great tropical forests were replaced by a lush grassland environment. A grassland environment broken by enormous oases of remnant rainforest. And in this remnant rainforest, the arboreal primates that lie far back in our family tree began to respond to environmental pressure and began to shift from a fruit-eating, large, almost entirely fruit and insect-eating diet to a more omnivorous diet because of the limitation of protein. They also began to experiment with descending from the trees to hunt small rodents and small animals that were inhabiting the grasslands, which were rich with evolving cereals of different sorts. Now, while all of this was going on, ungulate animals, animals like bison and cattle and buffalo and wildebeest and ibex and antelope, were evolving in great numbers on the African belt. So this drying trend was creating the savannas of the world. There never before had been savanna land on this planet, but it was coming into being in the interior of Sumatra, across the African belt, and in parts of India. And this special ecology of ungulate animals was evolving. Now, the primates who had been living in the trees already had a highly evolved pack signaling system. As you know, if you've observed howler monkeys or woolly monkeys in the jungle, they have a language of chirps and squeaks and shouts that is fairly dense, at least in the existential moment. Meaning they're not talking philosophy, they're tending to business. So attending this exploration of the surface, this leaving of the trees, was a tendency toward bipedalism, which reinforced the already existent tendency to binocular vision that had evolved in the arboreal environment. So you see, there's a kind of confluence here of factors: bipedalism, omnivorousness, binocular vision, a repertoire of pack signals, a social mode of existence already very old. And into this situation comes the opportunity to evolve in the grasslands into a larger pack hunting group that is now including meat in its diet and that is competing with these animals of the veld. There was a very interesting conference held a couple of years ago in which very straight paleontologists concluded that the great wave of extinction of the giant mammals that went on about 3 million years ago was actually a human-induced phenomenon. And this is why the woolly mammoth and Dimetrodon and the giant tree sloth and the giant armadillo and these huge, the Irish elk, these huge animals that used to roam the planet no longer exist. The human impact was already happening that far back. Rian's bailiwick seems to be sort of from the invention of agriculture to the atomic bomb. The area that I'm interested in has that embedded in it. I'm interested in sort of the time from the last glaciation to the first starship, whatever that may be. And, okay, to make a long story slightly shorter, the critical factor that enters in when you look at the evolution of human beings is a sudden and unexplained doubling in brain size about 50,000 years ago. Before that time, the human brain had enlarged itself only about 12% in the previous 2.5 million years. But suddenly, 50,000 years ago, the brain size doubled. At the same time, the Neanderthal flowering came to an end and they began to fade. The last Neanderthal skeleton that we have is 20,000 years old. So over a period of 20,000 years, these two species shared the planet. The X factor, the thing which changes everything, is, in my opinion, the fact that these pack-hunting, baboon-like, proto-hominoid primates encountered in the process of trailing behind these large mammalian herds that had evolved in the grassland, they encountered the manure of these creatures. And in this manure were the coprophytic, psilocybin-containing mushroom, specifically Stropharia cubensis. And I have observed the habits of baboons in East Africa, and it is, they are creatures of the belt. They are omnivorous. They scramble around, and every time they come to a cow pie, they flip it over because they're looking for grubs and bugs, which make up a major part of their diet. And they sniff. They're great sniffers and food testers. Well, the mushroom in this kind of environment is an extremely noticeable natural object. I've seen Stropharia cubensis mushrooms the size of dinner plates in Amazonian pasturage, standing on stalks 14 inches high. And the thing has, you know, this pearlescent, phallic, lunar, solar, it's everything. It's the perfect sacramental plant for a partnership society. It is as strongly phallic and solar as it is lunar and feminine. It's associated with the moon, and yet it has, you know, this brilliant golden yellow color. And it is yet a thing of the night, and is taken at night to enter into the mysteries of the night mother. So, looking for support for this idea, and I mentioned this earlier, I discovered that in the 1960s, Roland Fisher at the University of Maryland had given psilocybin to graduate students and then given them standard visual acuity tests. And he had discovered that small amounts of psilocybin actually increase scoring on a standard visual acuity test. And he was a very straight Viennese guy, but he had this elfin quality. And he said to me, "You see, my little friend, this is a case," as if I needed convincing, "this is a case where intoxication on a drug actually gives a truer picture of reality than the absence of the drug." And it was true. It was empirically so. You see better. Well, you don't have to know a lot about evolutionary theory to know that if there is a food or in the food chain of a population of animals that can confers increased visual acuity, and this animal is a hunting animal, then those individuals of the species that have this enzyme, alkaloid, steroid, whatever you want to call it, in their diet are going to have a selective adaptive advantage, and that their reproductive strategy will triumph, and so forth and so on. So this was astonishing to me, because this is an argument which is very appealing to the straightest kind of evolutionary biologists. And then I began thinking about the ignored role of foods in evolution, and the fact that we are omnivorous through what appears to be a series of chance events, which I just discussed. This omnivorous habit lays us open to tremendous numbers of mutagens, stimulants, depressants, quasi-sterilizing agents, spermicides, ovicides, neurological enzymes of all sorts. And so, really, this is a great untapped area for evolutionary biology to look at. Is it possible that the unexplained extension of adolescence in humans was somehow in effect synergized by steroids in the diet? What about the fact that women have a hidden ovulation, unlike other primates? There are a lot of questions about our sexuality and lactation, menstruation, all of these enzyme-controlled processes that might be very suggestive of studying the effect of steroids, alkaloids, hallucinogens, and whatnot in the proto-human diet. I don't know how many of you know, but the birth control pill is made from Dioscorides, which is yams. Thousands of acres of Mexican land are in these steroid-rich Dioscorean yams from which, I forget the names of the pills, is it Orthonovum, but whatever they are, it's made. Well, yams, sweet potatoes, are a staple of human populations in the tropics. And yet when you look at them chemically, there's a gradient from food to powerful reproductive addiction affecting drugs. And if primitive populations were not aware of this, or perhaps were aware of it, then they would have been using these effects or being subject to these effects. So this is a rich area. Leave alone the subject of the hallucinogens. I mean, you could look at stimulants and neurotoxins and all these other things I named. But of course, my special interest was the hallucinogens, because what I was interested in was the emergence of consciousness and this doubling of brain size. How could it have happened so quickly? Well, the scenario that I'm left with is that once this visual acuity thing was being reinforced in these pack-hunting primates, the next level of discovery, and I suppose all these discoveries I'm going to talk about were made almost simultaneously, was that twice the dose that increases visual acuity makes sexual activity extremely interesting, prolonged, variegated, and unusual. And it's fairly clear that these primates, looking at all the other primate species and their social activity and carrying on, I mean, we don't call it monkey business. So here you have this thing impacting so far in two critical areas. Number one, survival. You can see better to hunt your food and flee your enemy. Number two, it's an aphrodisiac and a stimulant. This will have an even more intense driving effect on the reproductive strategy of those individuals that are using it. Quite simply, they have sex more often. So naturally, they have their reproductive gene pool is advanced. But neither of these things, fascinating though they are, is to my mind the major stimulus that put this thing so center stage in calling us out of the monkey body and toward angelhood. Because after all, it's good for monkeys to see better, and monkeys do enjoy sex, but the way in which we differ from monkeys is our free command of mental constructs not present in the immediate environment. In other words, memory. Memory is the key to culture, I think. You have to have memory as a precondition for language, because if you don't have memory, what good is language? You have nothing to say. Memory is the precondition for writing, for all forms of epigenetic coding, etc. So to my mind, what's interesting about these vision-enhancing, sexually-stimulating alkaloids in the food chain is their impact on consciousness at yet higher doses. At doses four or five times that which affects visual acuity, you are suddenly conveyed into the realm of, for want of a better word, we would have to call it the holy, or the tremendum, or the mystery, or the mysterious. And at this point, suddenly, the historical experience of the last 10,000 years falls away and is practically useless. We are no better positioned to understand the thing encountered on high doses of plant hallucinogens than were the people of the late Neolithic. It remains utterly, overwhelmingly incomprehensible. It remains, you know, a living, breathing mystery experienced in the here and now. And so, as Gordon Wasson and others were quick to point out, it becomes the compass for the religious quest. An understanding of that mystery, an abiding in that mystery, becomes then the compass of the historical and prehistorical religious quest of human beings. And in this culture, this comes as news, I guess, because for over 2,000 years, we have been the victims of a dominator culture that left no stone unturned in trying to stamp out and suppress direct access to the logos, which was what these psychedelic sacraments that haunt prehistory were all about. What was happening at Eleusis, what was happening at Delphi, what was happening in the pagan mystery religions of the proto-Hellenic period was all the technological groping toward an accessing of the mystery. Eden, I believe, was this world of the African grasslands of 12 to 25,000 years ago, when in great pinnacles of wind-cut stone that rose above the desert, a partnership society based on human equilibrium in the gender question, pastoralism in terms of a lifestyle, and access of the goddess through her gift of the mushroom, that was this warfareless, Edenic, paradisical time. And it persisted until fairly recently. It persisted until 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 or 7,000 BC. Then the desertification of the Sahara became really serious, and those people, those Neolithic people, moved east and became the Neolithic pre-dynastic civilization in the Nile Valley, and then still further in the Tigris-Euphrates drainage, the tribal people who by 1,000 years preceded the civilizations that we know so much about, Sumer, Ur, and so forth. And they carried with them a goddess religion that was, I am willing to suggest, was where the central mystery was the mushroom. Now, the psychological dominance of the ego is something that came to be in the wake of these disruptive migrations out of the home range of the lead to a search for all kinds of substitutes, probably the invention of asceticism, and the rise of a priestly class. The shaman, in the absence of the sacrament that is truly living, becomes a theologian and a dogmatist and begins to put in place precepts and prohibitions. And it, suddenly nature is no longer friendly and supportive. Suddenly nature must be dealt with through a system of taboos and sacrificial efforts to propitiate, this sort of thing. This is indicative of alienation. Even though we find it at very primitive levels of society that we might at first brush be willing to embrace as expressions of a pure lifestyle. But I really don't think so. I think that the notion of sacrifice, which has been written about by Freud and Zimmer and all kinds of people, already indicates an uncertainty about our relationship to this other, that previously, you know, we were her children. We were entirely embedded in her, her rhythms, her needs, her energy flows. And the reason why I think all this is important, other than being an academic argument among primatologists and anthropologists, is because of what I've called the archaic revival. The fact that we are trying to grope toward a new model of how to be in the world. And if you, this is not the first time a society has been slammed to the wall. And if you are a student of history, you know that when societies reach great crises points, their reflex is inevitably conservative and to pull back. And the form this pulling back takes when the situation is truly desperate is to look back into the past for a stabilizing model that worked once before. And the last time this happened, in a context that we're probably all familiar with, is when the medieval world began to crack to pieces because of those spices that were being brought in from the east. They seem to have a real need to put pepper on their steaks. There may have been more than spices in those Genoan cargo boats. But anyway, at the end of the medieval world, the Christological eschatology began to crack apart. The Jews were turned loose to be bankers. The Italian city-states were turned loose to make money. And towns began to spring up. The lost Platonic corpus was translated into European languages, and a whole new world came into being. And the feeling of alienation and uncertainty and anxiety was assuaged by looking back into the past and saying, we need a model, and the medieval Gothic model won't work. We will become like Rome at its most grandiose. We will become like Greece at its most clear and philosophically brilliant. This is called classicism. It was invented in the 1400s, 2,000 years after Plato taught. Suddenly it was decided in Europe that a Platonic society would be created. And we are the inheritors of that society. We live under Roman law and Greek aesthetics and so forth and so on, because people who were sick of the medieval world decreed that it should be so. And the model worked up until the late 19th century, when the Greek analytical method met the instrumentalities of the Industrial Revolution, and we began to get the new science, or the big science, the science that was not about a country gentleman making notebook scratchings on the warblings of birds and the flow of streams, but where you actually say, my God, we can go for it, we can understand, we can extract the energy from the stars, we can light the fires of heaven in the deserts of our planet. This whole Faustian kind of science, where suddenly it isn't about understanding, it's about power, and about calling this power down upon your enemy. So we are now eight decades in to this era of mastery of energy and tremendous Faustian power, and we need a new model. And I think that the new model is such a huge form emerging onto the historical stage that we shouldn't be deluded that it's something which has come about since the early 70s, or that it was invented in the 60s. It reaches at least back to the late 19th century. I mean, people like Alfred Jarry and René Clair and Marcel Duchamp and these people, they were enunciating long before Freud and Jung the presence of the unconscious as a frontier into which the locomotive of Marxist history looked like it was headed with no return ticket in sight. And that's actually what happened. In the dreams of 19th century rationalism, the utopian schemes of Bellamy and Marx and all these people ran smack into the world of the unconscious, the world of the shaman, the world of the psychedelic experience, of modern art, of sexual liberation, of the stream of consciousness novel, cubism, futurism, spaceflight, all of these things. And these are, well, it's interesting to see, for instance, how modernism was invented by Picasso in some tellings of the story, but he couldn't do it until he had studied all these primitive masks from the coast of West Africa. And this was what everybody was, who was anybody in Paris in 1915, was decorating their apartments with, were these images of the primitive. So we are, I think, returning to the archaic mode. That's at least what is the shining hope. And what opposes it is the momentum of historical society, which is linear and cares to extend itself centuries into the future, male-dominated, technocratic, object-worshipping, and superficial in the most unsuperficial sense of the word. I mean, we have raised banality to an archetype. Hannah Arendt wrote a book called The Banality of Evil. Well, you know, I agree with the conclusions of the book, but if evil is banal, what is not? You know, this is a kind of pulling of energy out of the felt moment. So, Marshall McLuhan saw it, Tim Leary saw it, Bucky saw it, probably everybody and their dog saw it coming. What is happening is a kind of meltdown of print-created values and a kind of release into a new cultural space. But it's a cultural space that is new only to us. It is easily recognized as the cultural space in which shamans of great ability and courage have been operating for the past 50,000 years. They can show us the way. We can find our own way by following their example. The big news is that orthogonal, that means at right angles too, orthogonal to the entire historical process is a...
Welcome. This is Fane of the Cosmos, and for the moment you've been listening to Terence McKenna, part 4 of a 5-part series called Man and Woman. Yeah, wow. Love it. Love Terence. Now, let's take a break. I'll do another news story, then we'll go. This is White Rabbit. You might know that from such classics as the 60s. Gray Slick. And this is 1965.
back later.
Welcome back. You're listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio, 93.5 FM, CJLY, broadcasting live in Nelson. Now, you cannot forget, not this Saturday, well, not yesterday, but the Saturday coming up is the Wasabi Collect Eye benefit for the tsunami victims. And so, yeah, don't miss that, whatever you do. I was hoping to have one of them on the show, but I got carried away and I forgot to do a prank phone call on them, so I just tried calling, but nobody was there. Hey, if anybody at the Wasabi Collect-I commune could call into the radio station, 352-3706, and give me a heads up on more about this benefit gig, that would be great. Yeah, love those guys. Gonna have to get a babysitter or a kid sitter for Bird for that one, that's for sure. Now, in Edmonton, they're getting drug dogs into the schools. Ebony, a drug-sniffing canine with a nose for narcotics, will soon be working the hallway beat in local public high schools. On Monday, Edmonton Public Schools, in cooperation with the Edmonton Police Service, approved a passive drug dog pilot project in an effort to deter students from bringing drugs into schools. Ebony, a one-year-old black lab, has been working at Harry Ainlay High School for the past 8 months, alongside school resource officer Constable Doug Green. Dougie. While Ebony is trained to sniff out drugs like marijuana and crystal meth, she's used more for education than enforcement, says Green, who developed the Dogs for Drug-Free Schools program with Harry Ainlay Principal Mark Lingori. The most important goal of the program is to educate students about the risks of drug use, he said. Without education, then it just strictly becomes enforcement. We can already tell you what response to enforcement is. It doesn't work, says Green. Since Ebony joined Green, there has been a significant decrease in the number of drug-related incidents at the school, even though he hasn't actually done any drug searches with the dog, says Green. I have not had to use this dog to search within the school because it's not necessary. Everyone is aware she is there, says Green. The kids aren't prepared to take the chance. Ligori says the drug dog program is a proactive way to fight drugs in schools. We know that we have students who use drugs. We know that we have students that will deal in illegal drugs, and individuals will come to school specifically for that purpose. It is a significant deterrent, said Ligori. Ebony hasn't been used to sniff lockers or backpacks, he says, but students are aware Ebony might sniff them out if they bring drugs to school. It's just another tool we have to make students aware that we are serious about protecting them from illegal drugs, said Ligori. With Ebony by his side, she's the star of the show. Green has talked to around 9,000 students in both the public and Catholic school districts over the past 3 months about the dangers of drugs. Some kids might be bored when he talks, but when Ebony demonstrates her skills, it catches their attention. I always put out 8 or 9 things on the floor and have her go by and search them. When she finds drugs or the odor of drugs, she sits. All of a sudden, you start to see the students' eyeballs get bigger, says Green. Ebony has also helped him make more approachable to students, adds Green. Dogs break down barriers, especially between police and kids, says Green. Lisa Austin, Edmonton Public Schools spokesperson, says Ebony and Green will be available to visit district high schools on the request of principals. There was some interest on the part of other high school principals to have the dog come and visit the schools, and certainly parents supported this too, says Austin. The goal is to act as an educational opportunity for kids to understand better the risks associated with not just drug use, but possession, and to deter drugs from coming onto school grounds. If a search takes place and drugs are found, it will be up to the principal to decide whether to lodge a formal complaint with the police. The Catholic school system is also interested in the new program. Myself, I just don't really dig drug dogs when I'm going to school, you know? It's like, just reminds me of prison or like a boot camp or, you know, Guantanamo Bay or something like that. You know, it just seems like you're there to learn, but at the same time, you're considered this, like, I don't know. I just don't like it. It's like, how would you like going to your job and having, like, some dog in your office who's, like, there just to make sure you don't bring any smell into the office? I remember one time I was on the island at a medical cannabis conference, and I had had some early morning cannabis breaks, and had washed up, had got my clothes, had gone to a local prison to see one of my friends perform, actually, in a play in the prison. She wasn't an inmate, but she was playing one of the roles within the prison system, and I got refused to go into prison. I couldn't believe it, but the dog came, sniffed my fingers, and sat down. The guy's like, I'm sorry, but you have narcotics. And I was in, like, you know, hippie shorts and a t-shirt. Like, there's nothing on me, you know? It was just the smell. I don't know. It just felt degrading. So I'm not really into drug dogs, especially if I was going to school, you know? Like, do you trust me or do you not trust me? I don't know. It just breaks it down. And then he's like, isn't it cool? The kids really get their attention. I have put illegal drugs on the ground for the dog to find. Isn't that cool? I don't know. I'd be like, why do you get to have illegal... Obviously, the illegal drugs aren't, you know... Why do you get to carry it around? And, yeah. So, I'm against drug dogs in schools. Or any... How about panty-sniffing dogs? You know what I mean? Like, what the hell? Where does it end? Like, what are they sniffing for? Like, you know? I don't know. It's just too much for me. I can't handle drug dogs sniffing. Sniffing around. Sniffing. So we're nearly at the end of the hour, the 2 hours here. I'd like to give technical props up to DJ Alun, who's one of the digital fishermen. And what would it be? DJ Felici of the DJ Love for finding those Cassette Man samples. That was really sweet. We have another song here. This is Buffy St. Marie, and I've been wanting to play this on the radio show, but I haven't had a format, and Paul D made it for me today. So this is Buffy St. Marie, Universal Soldier, and from what he was saying, it kind of holds true for the whole Iraqi thing and on a whole bunch of levels. So here we go, Buffy St. Marie.
He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA, and he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders
That was Buffy Samurai, Universal Soldier. Now, I'll just cover this quickly just because I think it's pretty important and we need to do more of this where we live. Another multinational water privatizer is closing shop in South America's poorest and perhaps boldest country. On Monday, neighborhood organizations in the Bolivian city of El Alto launched an indefinite general strike demanding that Aguas de Illumani, a company operated by French giant Suez, immediately return the city's water system to public control. By Thursday, they were marching en masse to the capital to claim their victory and reiterate demands that extend to issues of electricity and gas. In an email sent Friday morning, Suez spokesperson Juan Greenwood said, Aguas de Illumani has not been informed officially that the water contract has been revoked, but Bolivian news reports say the government has issued Supreme Declaration 27973, which cancels the contract with Aguas de Illumani for water and sewer services in the twin cities of El Alto and La Paz, the national capital. Given the overwhelming and inescapable public pressure, the government appears to have had little choice. Greenwood says shareholders will use all legal recourses at their disposal to protect their rights. Ending a contract that is compliant and obtaining indisputable results will not be an easy task for the Bolivian government. Suez owns 55% of Aguas de Illumani shares, the World Bank 8%, and South American investors the remainder. Closed for business. While presidents, prime ministers, and mayors around the world confidently declare their jurisdictions open for business, the people of Bolivia are taking down the open sign. The events in El Alto and La Paz follow the landmark 2000 water war in Bolivia's third largest city, Cochabamba. After 5 months of dramatic public revolt, the people of Cochabamba regained control of their water system from U.S. giant Bechtel and its water privatizing partners. As for Suez, Greenwood says the company is quite simply held hostage in a purely ideological battle. The local electrical company Electropaz is also in the same position as it is the local branch of Telecom Italia. Who's next, one may ask. That seems to be the exact question on the minds of the powerful neighborhood organizations. Key among their other demands is the call for a reversal of recent government decreed increases in diesel and gas prices. The increase have sparked major protests in various parts of the country and resulting turmoil in government. Bolivia has oil and gas reserves second only to Venezuela on the continent, and Bolivians seem fed up with their resources benefiting foreign shareholders rather than their own nation. With the crescendo of popular unrest and civil society confidence, President Carlos Mesa issued a peculiar January 12th release stating he is receiving many emails asking him not to resign or reduce gas prices. Mesa's predecessor was driven from the country in October 2003 after oil-related protests left dozens dead. So, there we have it, folks. If a poor South American country can kick out a corporation, hell, we can. The whole BC liberal privatization agenda can be thwarted if we all... Why don't general strikes happen in this country? They happen in every other democracy. It's because we're too complacent and our media's got us by the necks, you know? We don't have general strikes. So, Vane of the Cosmos would like to put out a prayer for a general strike. And let's get some things changed here. This next election, let's get the liberals out. And who we're going to get in, we're not sure. But let's get the liberals out. And we have a chance to reverse all this privatization that's going on. A general strike, I think, would be really healthy for the country. Bring a lot of people together. Bring a lot of communities together. Let's ravage some corporations. Let's raise some privatized companies. Let's do it up. We have the power. People in other parts of the world, France, in Europe, they do it all the time. If they're pissed off, they have a general strike. They just say, okay, look, we're not going to, we'll make the trains not work, the highways blocked, everything. They make life hell. We can do that. We have the ability to put that into action and change things. So hopefully 2005 will be the year of general strike. Where we can reverse some of the ills of the BC Liberal government and the federal Liberal government, and protect the interests, protect the land, protect our rights. So we're drawing to an end. This has been Fane of the Cosmos Infinite Moment. I'm your host, Dustin Sunflower. We'll be with you next week. Hopefully Dan will be in the studio again. We'll be doing an interview. And stay tuned. Hopefully the show will also be on the A Infos Project, an activist radio archives that is on the web. And we're working on getting that up there. And once we have a website, we'll be